Okay, looks like the other class is starting, and I don't want them to get ahead of me. So I'm going to start, ready or not, here. This is Proverbs number 8. It's the final study here. We managed to make it through 31 chapters in 8 weeks, or at least we will by the end of today. And it's been interesting. We've taken several approaches to this book. We realize this book is more complex than you might have thought of at first, because you think of the classic Proverbs, and you think, well, it's just one of those right after another for 31 chapters, and you find out it's not like that. And of course, we looked at it from different angles. We said the first 9 chapters of the book serve as something of an introduction, really, comparing wisdom with you might say, foolishness, or let's just leave it at foolishness. We go from there into short proverbs that appear to have been authored or collected very directly by Solomon. We see that some of those were disjunctive and some of them were, what's the other word, synthetic, I think they call it for the big words if you're studying peremiology. Remember that great word, the study of wisdom sayings? A peremiologist looks at them. The disjunctive ones would throw out a couple of lines, and then the next 2 lines would be a contrast, the exact opposite. So the wise man, the fool. The beautiful woman, the indiscreet woman, or something like that. And then the synthetic ones just, the fool is like, and then develop it, and they add things together. We saw, though, that there are several sections. We go from the Proverbs of Solomon to the words of the wise. We think those are perhaps drawn from the works of a pharaoh, a Meniopian. We looked at Solomon and his connection with Egypt, maybe because he was married to one of Pharaoh's daughters. Now, that was not known, 100, 200 years ago in the study of Proverbs, because they just hadn't done the archaeological work and found the manuscripts and things like that. But that does change things, because if you look a few hundred years ago, people were interested in defending Solomon as the author of the Proverbs as if he wrote them. Where is that coming from? Oh, I just couldn't figure out where it came from. Anyway, when you think of that biblically, there's no biblical need to defend that idea. There's no biblical requirement to say that in the name of defending the scriptures that this couldn't be a textured work with multiple authors as long as it's kind of presented as such. Now, for example, we had the words of the wise. We see in chapter 25 the men of Hezekiah collected another set of proverbs. And as it pointed out, this is 270 years after the time of Solomon, so that it probably can't be handed to Solomon. We saw last week, we looked at the words of Agur and studied those and looked at it. So we see that there are layers here. And the original form of the book was a collection, and that Solomon undoubtedly was not just an author of Proverbs, but also a collector of Proverbs. And I said, in no case does he seem to be hesitant about adapting this freely to the life of a Jew who believes in our God. He'll grab them and use them for the occasion. I don't know what modifications he might have subjected them to in that regard. We see some of the parables have some narrative to them, some story, some explanation. Others just leave you hanging. They don't offer you an interpretation of what's going on there. All of them seem to be about the good life, a good life in the Lord, a good life as a person of faith, and success, and leadership, and avoiding self-defeat, avoiding foolishness that leads to ruin, not just for you, but for others. Remember, we said this seems to be aimed at a class of people who will take on roles of leadership. And so we do some adapting for ourselves. We're not exactly in the same situation that the courtiers were of Solomon's day. But I think it was Bob Zacharich who pointed out that we all lead and follow. That's true to everybody's experience, if only in their own household and own family. Another thing that's rich in the Proverbs and looking at it this way is diagnosis. Diagnosing a situation. What's really taking place behind the actions of people? In the sense, you can use these to diagnose yourself. What's really making me tick in this situation? And so we work at it that way. Well, we're in the last one. We're in the final chapter, and we've got yet another collection of Proverbs. And would somebody just read us 31:1? 31:1. Very good. Lemuel is the a king. Now, there were people in the days of trying to defend this as maybe once again a pseudonym, a pen name for Solomon, but I don't think most people accept it. A lot of people didn't even accept it back in the day. They thought something about this doesn't match. For one thing, who would Solomon's mother be? Bathsheba. That would make this an interesting study, wouldn't it? Because the whole story of Bathsheba and her reign as queen would be intriguing. A lot of people, though, even back in the day, say 300-400 years ago, were wondering, would this match some of the language here if this were Bathsheba and rejecting the idea? Nonetheless, is the source of these Proverbs surprising to you? These ones, 31, this little collection here. So what's the source? Somebody's mom. Yeah, does that surprise you for any reason? Why do you find it delightful? Is it clearly directed at... Well, the source is a woman and a mother, and we want to keep that in mind as we look down through here and study it. And if you're looking for that kind of input in the Scripture, which isn't frequent, you'd have it here. Now, one of the interesting things that happens is we come to the famous Proverbs 31 woman, which is both elevated and bashed. Because the chapter spends a lot of time on this woman, and I've heard her referred to in less than that, if you'll pardon me, darned Proverbs 31 woman, as if she's setting an example that's just absolutely impossible. It's just a piece of a ridiculous elevation that no one could live up to and will then be used to beat women forever for how they won't live up to that standard. And that's, of course, happened, but I think you'll find out it's very different. One of the very interesting things is, you know how the Hebrew Scriptures work. The Hebrew Scriptures, the way this would be in the Jewish Old Testament, the way the words would have been collected. Now, this wouldn't have been back in the day when this was first written, but as Jewish Scriptures have been compiled, you had something called the Tanakh. Torah, those would be the five books of Moses, you know, the Nevi'im, these would be the prophets, and then you had the Ketuvim, the wisdom writings. And the wisdom writings are the ones you usually think of with that, Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, I believe Job, and Song of Solomon are there. But what really follows the book of Proverbs in the Jewish Bible, does anybody know? Because the order is all different. Ruth. And there have been people who have gone so far as to suggest that in fact, it's greasing the rails for the book of Ruth. That there was a very deliberate placement of the book of Ruth as the example of excellent womanhood after the Proverbs 31 woman. I don't know that you can prove anything there, but it's intriguing. Verse 2. Somebody read us verse 2, 31:2. And what's your first word?
Oh, my son.
Really? Nothing else? What translation is that? Really? Anybody else have anything else?
I have, listen, my son. Listen, son of my womb. Listen, my son. Answer my womb. Answer my prayer.
Listen, listen, listen. You don't have anything like that. You know, I didn't look at NIV before I did this. It's really fascinating. Like I don't want to be a wonk here, but in Hebrew there's this word ma, what, and it's like what, What my son? What son of my womb? What's that? Yeah, and that's what I was studying. I was doing that in ESV, and I assumed that was in there. What, my son? And what, my son? What, son of my womb? And what, son of my vows? Now, I feel like NIV depletes something there. I know that word's in there, but what does that sound like suddenly if we do it that way? And I think Kate's Listen does it too. Vicki, were you going to say something? ESV. Well, that's what I'm thinking there with that. I know that word what is there. Now, translation's always translation. So maybe they're being a little helpful there in the ESV and casting it in, down a certain line here. But what does it sound like? What's the tone then of this passage? Well, kind of, right? I mean, it's more like, what were you thinking? That's about it for me. I mean, I just picture, what are you thinking? What? Listen. And we get a couple of things then that he better listen. And there are two of them in categories here. Now, if you look down through there, we'll see the first one shows up in verse 3. What is it? Yes, women again. Now, you think about who we're dealing with here. If he's a king, he was a prince. A prince has sort of the ability to live as decadent a life as he wants. And you can imagine that there was a lot of that going on there. I mean, he could be a womanizer. He could reduce that. You almost wonder from the tone of verse 2 if he hasn't already set down that course a little bit and said, do not give your strength to woman, nor your ways to that which destroys kings. And then we get the second topic in verse 4. Okay. Let's just say alcohol. There wasn't really distilled alcohol back in those days. It was all fermented alcohol, you know, just. All right, well, so if you'd say this mother's looking at her princely son, and there's a tone of a little bit of alarm, I think, in two, then she's saying, look at the things princes fall into. Some really predictable traps. One of them is that he would be susceptible just to a sensuality with women. The other would be that he would just pickle himself and lose things. And there, then, you get an elaboration that really covers the rest of the book. Now, what we'll see, and we might as well just read it because it's not really very long. But let's take the alcohol ones first. So verses 4 and 5. 4, 5, 7 are the alcohol line. Let's take 4 through 7. Would somebody read what the problem with alcohol is? Okay, very good. Thanks, Murph. All right, so just like we'll find in women here, when he through her launches out, we've kind of got the, you know, sort of proper use and negative use of alcohol. But let's talk about the negatives. What are the consequences of him as a king being soused? What's the outcome? Bad judgment affecting whom? Well, yeah. When you think about that, it's very interesting that I mean, it's not a question of personal corruption through alcoholism or something like that. I mean, it's really a question of perverting justice, right? So you see what should kings be about? If they forget the law, they pervert justice of all the afflicted. Do you see that? So who are the afflicted? Well, I'd say anybody. Yeah, well, I mean, not everybody at all times, but I mean, you say that, you know, that in a sense, you say that at least government as it's conceived here is about caring for people who are beat up, downtrodden, that it's not a heartless Darwinian, if you would, approach to kingship, but your job is to, in a sense, look out for some people here, in particular the afflicted. If you go down to verses 8 and 9, you'll see more. Somebody read us 8 and 9. Right. So the consequences of the king becoming a lush, you know, becoming an alcoholic, is that it a hard heart then gets full rein, and he doesn't protect. We get, once again, we said the afflicted. Here we say, verse 8, I have, in the cause of all who are appointed to die. What did you have, Becky? You read something different there. Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't look at that one real closely here to find out what was going on there, but that would be quite, I think literally I have in my note, sons of passing away. I guess that could be destitute. If you're destitute enough, you're going to die, I guess. Open your mouth for other people. Speak for them. Judge righteously. Plead the cause of the poor and the needy. All right. So that would be the pitfalls. If you fall into the wrong path in alcohol, you neglect that thing that's dear to the heart of God, the afflicted, the poor, the needy, the speechless, those who don't have a voice. The positive side, though, of alcohol, since God gives wine to make glad the hearts of man, as the Psalms say, what is the positive side of alcohol here? Its proper use, if you will.
Those who are perishing
are in anguish. Yeah. Verse 6, give strong drink to him who is perishing. Wine to those who are bitter of heart. If you were to cast this in modern medicinal terms, what would you be thinking here? Yeah. Who said morphine? Yeah, I think you've got two categories, right? You've got one, the person who's dying. Now just think about this. This is a world before medicine, surgery, OxyContin, you know, I don't know. You know, it's a world before aspirin, for heaven's sakes. I mean, I'm not prissy about alcohol in that sense. I'm sure I recommend a life of non-use of alcohol, but I'm not prissy about that sense. Look, if I lived back in those days, I would say, yeah, if somebody's in great pain, if they're dying, why wouldn't you do whatever you could do to ameliorate their condition of suffering by helping them with their pain? But it's not only that, though, right? The person who's dying, what's the next one? I have give strong drink to him who is perishing. What's your second part of that proverb? Okay, so what are we treating with alcohol there? Yeah, which is kind of a pitfall, right? When you think about it, that's like self-medicating yourself for depression with alcohol is a classic trap. But I think the idea, of course, is, I mean, well, look. They had no other means by which to treat some of this stuff. I mean, you know, their herbalism, I'm sure, wasn't there. So he said, but there's a proper use for alcohol here, according to this. And I find it very interesting. Let's go down this other column here, the famous Proverbs 31 woman. It goes from 10 through 31. We'll read the whole thing. In the Hebrew, this is an acrostic. An acrostic is, you've got another one of these in Psalm 119 in the Bible, where you just take the alphabet and you say, you know, like A is for the apple that she ate this morning or something, and B is for the, you know, you map out this picture, and it's sort of poetic by taking the first letter of everything. Well, the Hebrew does this for the Proverbs 31 woman in 10 through 31. It takes the first letter of the alphabet, the second letter of the alphabet, and it punches out the story going down through the alphabet. Why would you do that? Right, it's a mnemonic device, right? I mean, you know, you could say, well, you know, what do I remember? That was the Aleph, you know, that was the, you know, you go through the it's for memory. We're saying a lot of this is for training. So let's do 10 through 31. We'll read the whole thing. And would somebody read us 10 through 22, and then I'll have somebody else read 23 through 31. Thanks, Tom. Now think of the symmetry here in this book. It's really interesting. I mean, we start with those first nine chapters that portray wisdom as a beautiful and discreet woman, and foolishness as kind of the painted seductress who can lead you astray. So think of its situation with the book of Ruth following, and does Ruth match any of this? Would that be an interesting avenue to pursue to understand it? We look just in this chapter, and we see that in verse 3, do not give your strength to women nor your ways to that which destroys king. Is the idea that you once again have the contrast of two women here. One who is just a dead end for you, who will squander your fortune, and other than who is going to be a tremendous asset, if you will. I mean, that's somewhat demeaning, but a tremendous power in your life. And that's where Lemuel's mother directs him. Let me just ask you, and in particular the women, what is your reaction here? Is this like a woman you despise because it's just a hopelessly overblown image of someone, or is it someone you admire and enjoy? Anyone else? It is a lofty picture, right? I mean, I mean, you look at that and say, well, who is this person who actually is like this? Is there such a person? Well, really beyond perfect. Well, what if you had to characterize? I mean, you have 11 or 21 verses there. What would you summarize this woman to be like? I mean, if you had to just sort of take away the images of the Bible right there, who do you picture? What kind of a person? Or would there be a kind of seminal verses there that you would say, well, that about tells it right there? So what we say is, would you think strong would be the word if you had to put it in a word?
Industrious.
Sleepy. Other comments? I mean, if you had to summarize.
It seems like she works sacrificially. It's all based on others, on yourself. A martyr.
A martyr. Well, I just wonder, you know, clearly I don't think the Bible puts passages in this to kind of grind you down. You know, say, well, here's an impossible picture. See if you can live up to this. I mean, this is clearly not what the Word of God's there for. It's to bring healing and light and inspiration to us. So just... And that's particularly interesting when you think of verse 31, though, because is this to be boiled down to, oh, and then your husband will really, really talk you up, which seems painfully sexist. I think verse 31, what does your verse 31 say? Yeah. Or if in my mind, give her of the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gate. I think in a sense you're fending off that notion that this woman is to work herself to death so her husband has a trophy wife. I think it's saying this woman has dignity of her own, and that your interference of that, O prince, O my son, would you please listen to me, is not to see her in terms only of yourself, but to give her her own, well, not block her ability to have her own work speak for her. Give her the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her in the gates. Remember, her husband was sitting at the gate. He was looking good because of her, but in fact, he's saying, let her own fame be there. In some ways, I think 25 and 26 summarize the woman for me. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness, which is a wonderful... A horrible Frankenstein of a woman. No, no.
No, I just mean they're bringing out good qualities of many different people and saying many women do noble things. Mm-hmm. Not saying that every woman is
all of the above. Yeah, I think that's right. I think we're dealing with an ideal here. And I certainly don't think it's put in the scriptures to give women an impossible standard, nor do I think it's there to... for men to see their wives entirely in terms of what's in it for them and the glory it brings them, that would be perverse too, according to 31. I think 25 and 26, as I said, summarize it for me, that this is a human being with strength, honor, and wisdom and the law of kindness working in her heart. Where do you... you said that she was, you know, seeing where she was. I mean, this would be a queen, really, you know. When you read this as a modern person, where do you see this playing out? Because obviously, yeah, it's not a middle-class American. It's not really even, I mean, we're looking thousands of years ago. I mean, so how do you apply it today? The First Lady. Yeah, well, there'd be a problem in approaching this biblically with a kind of hyper-literalism. I mean, because if you say, well, I look at it literally, you say, really, your wife goes and looks for wool and flax, what would that mean for a modern woman, a modern Christian woman, a modern middle-class woman who's looking at this and saying, what does she see in these kinds of things? As you said, the merchant ships and... the provision there. She considers a field and buys it. You say, what? Considers a stock and invests. I don't know. An investment opportunity? I don't know what a distaff is. Anybody know? Weaving? She stretches out her hand to the distaff. Get that? She stretches out her hands to distaff 19, and her hands hold the spindle. I mean, what would that mean in the 21st century? She takes hold of that mouse. She goes online. What? And doesn't waste her time, you know? She's like, I'm... Grab hold of your medical education, take hold of that scalpel, go out and conquer cancer. You know, is that... Yeah. Well, verse 31 seems to keep saying that, give her the fruit of her hands and let her own works praise her, and the gates seem to be saying that to me. It's interesting, though, that of course, a traditionalist would defend this as working with entirely within a domestic sphere. I'm not sure you can support that from this when I look at the list of activities there and try to cast them back into those centuries and thinking, this is not necessarily a domestic sphere. As a matter of fact, a queen would have servants doing all that other stuff anyway. This is really active life of commerce, business, and activity. It is interesting to look at the interpretations of the past, though, that have always assumed a domesticity to this particular passage. And I'm saying, Vicki and I've lived, in some ways, a very traditional life in that regard. But I'm just saying, what can you apply scripturally or find scriptural warrant for it? I was greatly amused by Matthew Henry. If you've ever read him, 18th century Calvinist, I believe, commentator, and his Bible commentaries are everywhere, and they're real flowery, but they're enjoyable if you can plow through them. He's full of insights. I've really enjoyed him, but I got him on this one and read it, and I just couldn't help but be amused, so I copied it down. I'm going to read it to you because of his assumption that this will only ever play out in a domestic sphere, that it doesn't reach beyond. I think, well, that probably reflects 18th century England better than it reflects ancient Near East, for one thing. I mean, not to assume that there isn't any kind of gender distinction or anything going on, or even any unhealthy patriarchy back in the day, but he clearly reflects his own day age. So he gets to this and he says, in particular with verse 23, do you see that? Her husband is known in the gates. When he sits among the elders of the land, she makes linen garments and sells them. So here's Henry. By his cheerful countenance and pleasant humor, it appears that he has an agreeable wife at home. For many that have not, have their tempers strangely soured by it. There's a guy who's unhappily, can you imagine living with her? 24, the poor guy, he's worn out. Nay, by his appearing clean and neat in his dress, everything about him decent and handsome, yet not gaudy, one may know he has a good wife at home that takes care of his clothes.
He got all that.
Yeah. He has a good wife at home that takes care of his clothes. Has Matthew Henry done justice to the Proverbs 31 woman? Isn't there kind of a tension in the modern world? Because I don't know of any Christian who would want to dismiss the domestic sphere and the women who have dedicated themselves fully to it. I was born in 1956, and I was born into a different world. I mean, my mother was a graduate student and then a professional woman. I mean, I did not come home to a mother in an apron baking cookies. So it's not like I have a connection to the world. I can vaguely picture my grandmother, one grandmother doing it, and the other grandmother not doing it at all. I think she worked too. So that world changes. Those cultural forms change so much. I'm just thinking, well, how do you read this and preserve everybody's dignity? And that's why I come with strength and honor are her clothing, rejoice in the time to come, a mouth full of wisdom, and on her tongue the law of kindness. I think that could play out in any sphere. Any sphere that someone chose. And that would be an impressive person. I don't know how you... Do you regard the previous generations of women in your family kind of depressed or oppressed or limited or? Yeah. I think we can't stress that enough with these Proverbs, is they're just not just general advice. I mean, they're to be played out in piety, in faith in God, with the idea that all through the book of Proverbs, God is a player, not an abstraction, but right here, and the people who serve him are the only ones who really have a chance to get to this. I thought as a way of closing, we should go back to the very beginning of the book of Proverbs, since this is our last class, and think about this even in terms of what we just studied here. We need to read chapter 1, verses 2 through 7. Chapter 1, 2 through 7, and just use that as the closing. Remind ourselves of what we've covered for 8 weeks now. I'll read. To know wisdom and instruction, to perceive the words of understanding, to receive the instruction of wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity, to give prudence to the simple, to the young man knowledge and discretion, A wise man will hear and increase in learning, and a man of understanding will attain wise counsel. To understand a proverb and an enigma and the words of the wise and their riddles. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. That's what guided us through that study. So I'm finished. If you have maybe want a last word on the book of Proverbs.
Thank you. It was very interesting.
I enjoyed it. When I launch these, I always wonder, will that work? Before the first class, I think, that's not going to work. Why did I pick Proverbs?
Thank you.
That's good. Thanks for joining me.